Discovering God's Fingerprints, Why the Christian Faith Makes Sense. An abstract of this talk, God exists, and he's actually provided quite adequate evidence of this for those who really want to know. We look at the evidence of the universe, problems with atheistic evolution, evidence of design in inanimate nature, fulfilled prophecy in the Bible, Jesus of Nazareth, changed lives, and changed societies. Is religion wishful thinking, as some people seem to feel? Well, I'm not sure to what extent that might be true of one religion or another, but I don't think it's true of biblical Christianity. Why would Christians invent a God who needs nothing so you can't earn his favor? If you're doing wishful thinking, you would certainly want to invent a God who you can earn his favor, Why would Christians invent a God who sees the most righteous as deserving punishment? Surely if you are doing wishful thinking, you would invent a God who would think that you're okay, Why would Christians invent a God who holds those who know him better to a higher standard? Most of us, if we are doing wishful thinking, would invent a God who would give a break to those who know him better. If Christianity is wishful thinking, why would Christians invent a God who will forgive the worst who repent? That certainly seems counterindicative. If Christianity is wishful thinking, why would Christians invent a God who would condemn the most righteous who depend upon themselves? Again, that seems counterindicative. Now, one might argue that atheism is wishful thinking. It's easy to see why atheists wouldn't want a God who will judge all their actions and thoughts, and so they might just imagine there's no such God. It's easy to see why atheists wouldn't want a God who restricts their behavior. They would prefer to think that they can do what they want. In fact, Aldous Huxley, in his book Ends and Means, one of the reasons he suggests for why he opted for a worldview of meaninglessness was that it gave free play for him to do what he wanted. It's easy to see why atheists wouldn't want a God who condemns their sins. They would rather like to think that it doesn't matter what you do. Well, so maybe Christianity isn't wishful thinking after all. Is religion a crutch? This is another idea that's rather common and often given as a reason for people rejecting religion in general or Christianity in particular. Well, I think we have to say here that yes, religion is some sort of crutch. We're understanding the term crutch to be a metaphor, figure of speech. But certainly it's a fair question to raise, do we need a crutch? Crutch is something that helps a person get along when they've got a leg injury, let's say. And presumably a crutch in this kind of context would be religion is something that helps you to get through life when you might otherwise have more trouble. Question, of course, we need to raise for ourselves is, do we have the right sort of crutch? It would be rather nasty to have a crutch that helped you get through life pretty well, but when you died, it turned out it was the wrong crutch altogether and had led you into wishful thinking that you were okay when in fact you weren't okay. But as long as you've got the right sort of crutch, it's certainly better to have a crutch than not to be able to walk. A third objection you sometimes hear against Christianity or other religions is that Christianity is humanity is okay. Well, is humanity okay? Where's crime come from? Well, some might say, well, it's not really the criminal's fault, it's really the fault of society. Well, what society? A bunch of humans, In fact, society is more humanity than any single individual is. Where does poverty come from? Same thing. Can you blame it on your circumstances? Well, circumstances can have a huge effect there, okay? But, it may well be that society has messed some people up in various ways. But still, you're back to humanity, What about wars? All the wars we fought so far have been wars involving humans. What about abortion? Killing little babies? Killing pre-babies, if you want to call them that? Is that okay? Does that show that humanity is okay? What about AIDS? Is humanity really okay? And there's lots more besides those. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said early in the 20th century that you didn't really need the Bible to see there was something wrong with humanity. All you needed was the newspaper. Well, our talk today is Discovering God's Fingerprints, Why the Christian Faith Makes Sense. We use the term God's fingerprints as a metaphor to indicate that God has left evidence that he exists, just as a person leaving fingerprints at the scene of a crime would be an indication that he exists and might even indicate who that person is. We're going to suggest that God does exist and that he's actually provided quite adequate evidence of his existence for those who really want to know. Now, if you don't really want to know, the evidence might not beat you over the head. We want to consider the nature of the universe, problems with atheistic views of evolution, design in inanimate nature, fulfilled prophecy in the Bible, the phenomena surrounding Jesus Christ, and change lives and change societies. Let's look first of all at the existence of the universe. This talk is a fast tour. A number of these areas I've covered in more detail in other PowerPoint talks, but this one's kind of a survey. Back in the 19th century, it was very common among many scientists, particularly those who were atheists, to believe that our universe was static. That is, the stars were moving around among each other, but there really weren't any large-scale changes going on, and that the universe had always existed, even though one might raise the question of whether stars shine forever or not. The movement into the 20th century saw a shift from a static, eternal universe to a dynamic universe of some sort, a universe in which things are changing, in which the stars are running down, in which the universe seems to be expanding. The upshot of that was a move to two competing classes of theories, which we call the steady-state theory of the universe and the Big Bang theory of the universe. The steady-state theory of the universe said, yes, stars are running down, and yes, objects in the universe are moving apart, but the universe is still eternal and infinite, but it's just not static. Okay? New matter is popping into existence everywhere in the universe to keep this universe going, and that new matter is popping into existence by purely natural causes. The Big Bang, by contrast, said, the universe that we see had some kind of a beginning at the Big Bang, and it's been expanding since then, and the stars have been running down, and there were various varieties of the Big Bang. But in the course of the late 1960s and early 70s, the Big Bang model eventually won out. Among the Big Bang models, there were several alternatives, of which the two major ones were the oscillating universe, the idea that the universe would have a Big Bang every 100 billion years or so, and then would expand from that and eventually run out of steam and collapse back and bounce and have another Big Bang. And so you had an eternal universe that was oscillating, rather like an accordion going in and out, but playing a long tune, if you like. The alternative to that was the idea that the universe actually had a beginning at the Big Bang, and that bounces don't occur in our universe. Well, the upshot has been now in the last 20 years or so that the no-bounce universe, no-bounce Big Bang, has won out over the oscillating universe. And so the current situation is, it looks like we've either got a universe that began from nothing at the Big Bang, or that somehow we've got an infinite eternal universe which we can never see, which produces bubbles like our universe, that didn't bounce, they just pop up and expand. Scientific guru today, if you like, the fellow in the wheelchair who is the author of A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking, basically winds up by the end of his book claiming that the universe basically popped into existence out of nothing without a cause, because he can explain away time by some hand-waving, if you like. A rather drastic direction for such a person to go. Perhaps more popular would be the idea that our universe is just a bubble in a pre-existing universe, which has always been around. But both of those do things that are very strange that scientists would certainly not have liked earlier on. One, explaining the whole universe as having no cause, or two, explaining that the really important parts of the universe are stuff that we'll never be able to see beyond our observation. I think Hugh Ross characterized the picture that we see in this whole area rather succinctly when he said that the history of cosmology, the study of the universe as a whole, has in the 20th century been an increasingly frantic attempt to avoid a universe with a beginning in the face of mounting evidence that the universe really had a beginning. And I would suggest that that's true, and that a creator and a universe that had a beginning is a more adequate explanation of the data of cosmology we see than any of the alternatives that are currently circulating out there or that have been shot down in the last century or so. Well, some may say, okay, well, we perhaps never know the answer to the origin universe, but what about evolution? Doesn't evolution remove the need for God? Doesn't the ability to explain where life came from and its diversity by a purely natural process show us that we don't really need a God, and therefore there's no need to go back and talk about some creation event when we won't be able to look at it directly anyway? Didn't Darwin really show there's no need for a creator? Well, my answer, short answer, would be no, he didn't. And the reason he didn't was that there are serious problems with evolution. What are these problems with atheistic evolution, particularly? Theistic evolution would have a different set of problems. Well, one of these problems is the origin of life. Life is pretty complicated now that we can get down and actually look at it very carefully. One of the points of Michael Behe's recent work, Darwin's Black Box, was that when Darwin first proposed his theory, the cell, kind of the basic thing in plants and animals, the basic unit of life, if you like, was a black box. We didn't know what was going on inside it. We knew that it took nutrients in and expelled accretion, excretory products, and that it could make copies of itself and that sort of thing, but we really didn't know what's in it. Well, now we've got a whole lot better idea of what's in it than we did at Darwin's time. And it's so complicated that it really staggers the imagination to think that this is something that happened by itself without some kind of design or planning. A second problem with atheistic evolution is mutation and natural selection as a source of order. It's true that once you have something that can make copies of itself, and you can make little changes in the copies, then that if you make changes that happen to improve its functioning, it's likely that those changes will be favored over the ones that leave it alone, if you like, and so you could get things that work better and better as a result of that. But what we see in living things is something that's many orders of magnitude more than that. You see new structures showing up in the history of life. And these new structures look like they're not something that can be made by very small changes. They look like they're something that require a number of coordinated changes to make new, what shall we say, organs, new chemical processes, things of that sort, that have what Michael Behe called irreducible complexity to them. That is that if you take out one part, the whole thing doesn't work at all. And so you have to figure out some way to develop a whole coordinated sequence of things to operate. A third problem with atheistic evolution is a lack of transitions in the fossil record. It's true, as you look at the fossil record, there are fossils that look like they might be intermediates between this and that sort of living thing that we think might then have been the link between one and the other. But we really don't have many of those. We really have far fewer of those than one would ever guess if the history of life is something that happened without a mind guiding it, without any minds in the universe until those minds evolved. When you're thinking about an atheistic universe, a mindless universe, the transitions that occur in living things, on the assumption you've already got living things, are going to be random walks of some sort, in which there's no guidance, there's no direction, etc., and the mutations go off in all sorts of directions. And so it should leave behind all sorts of transitional fossils in getting from one type of living thing to a rather diverse sort of thing that's a descendant from it. We don't see that. These things together, the origin of life, the problem of mutation and natural selection is explaining the complex structures in living things, and the lack of sufficient transitions in the fossil record suggests that the creator is a more natural explanation for the origin and history of life than atheistic evolution. This whole idea of the creator as a designer behind things is more clearly seen in evidence of design in the non-animate part of nature, where you do not have mutation and natural selection as a putative source of this apparent design. Well, what kind of design do we see in inanimate nature? Well, chemistry looks designed. We have some material here in our other PowerPoint talks that go into this in more detail, Michael Denton, in his book Nature's Destiny, goes into great detail about the many, many complex things in chemistry that seem to be flukes. And yet, if they weren't there, you couldn't have life. Chemistry looks designed. Water looks designed. We find that phosphorus looks designed, the structure of ATP, ADP, and AMP as being able to very efficiently provide energy for the more complex plants and animals, etc., is impressive in this regard. Many, many features of that sort in chemistry. Our environment looks designed. We have a much more detailed discussion of this in our talk, Cosmos and Contact, where we discuss the striking nature of our environment here on Earth and the place of our Earth in our solar system, the kind of sun it's got, the kind of moon it's got, that we have a big planet like Jupiter in a circular orbit protecting us from meteor bombardment, that our sun is in the right place in its galaxy, and it's the right kind of galaxy, and that sort of thing. Our environment looks designed. The basic forces of the universe look designed. And we have four basic forces we know about in our universe. The strong force that holds a nucleus together, holds the neutrons and protons in our nucleus together. The electromagnetic force that holds the electrons to the nucleus of an atom and holds the molecules together, the weak force that holds the neutron together, and the gravitational force that holds us on the surface of our planet and our atmosphere on our planet and holds our planet in a stable orbit around our sun and the sun in an orbit around the galaxy, etc. These basic forces look designed in this very striking sense, that they're very fine-tuned to allow life in our universe. Far more fine-tuned than any science fiction writer would have guessed 50 years ago, huh? That if you make very small changes, some a few percent, some even one part in 10 to the 40th changes in these forces, you would have a universe that would not support life. Well, I've gotten ahead of myself a little bit. Designed in chemistry, the element carbon is unique in the length of chains formed. There has rather few competitors in the whole of the elements in our periodic table, but carbon is unique in that it will form long chain molecules, and that the binding between carbon and carbon is a very similar energy to that between carbon and oxygen, carbon and hydrogen, carbon and nitrogen, etc. And so a great diversity of molecules can be formed based on carbon, as contrasted with the few other elements that do form some chains, like silicon or germanium, something of that sort, which have very different strength of the bonds, and therefore don't provide the diversity that carbon does. Water, unique in its high heat capacity, and the fact that it's a universal solvent, and the fact that it expands on freezing, features that are crucial for living things. Phosphorus, we already mentioned, unique in its ability to transfer energy. Designed Earth, we've talked a little bit about that. The temperature in water on the Earth, the amount of oxygen, the gravity of the Earth, its location in the solar system, its location in the galaxy, the type of sun we've got, the type of moon we've got. In fact, another 60 or so items beyond that our Earth is right in a window on each of these 60-some items, that if you go a little bit higher, you won't get life on Earth. If you go a little bit lower, you won't get life on Earth. And we work out the probabilities of all of these things being in each of these windows. It's astronomically small. It's far smaller than the number of planets we've got in our universe, as far as we can tell. Universe, the Earth looks designed. Fine-tuned basic forces. The strong force is pretty important that it be where it is, that we have the diversity of elements that we do. The weak force, very important that it be where it is, that we have the diversity of elements that we have, and that they be available to us here away from the star, outside a star, our planet. The electromagnetic force, rather important that its size be what it is to actually have stable molecules. And the gravitational force has to be in the right range it is in order to have long-lived stars. There are other features of the fine-tuning of the basic forces that are really quite astounding when you consider that nobody would have guessed these things would be that fine-tuned. And they are, and they point to a designer. Well, one can make alternative explanations for these things. One can say that this is a mere accident of observation. In order to have observers in the universe, you have to have a universe that is designed looking enough in order to support life. Well, it's granted. But that's way more designed looking than anybody would have guessed. Very, very astonishing. And the alternative explanation, having said that, has to say, well, there must be lots of universes out there. There must be an infinity of them, or at least 10 to the several hundred of them, etc. But in fact, we've really got no good evidence for more than one universe. There might be, but we really don't have any good evidence for it. So here, it's not the theists that are making guesses beyond the evidence, it's the atheists that are making guesses beyond the evidence. And in fact, given the evidence, a creator is a more plausible explanation. Well, we may need to think about these things more, and we've got several PowerPoint talks that look into these in some more detail. But at this point, we'd suggest that what we know about the universe points to theism. So you might say, okay, well, there's a God or there are gods, But why should we think it's this God of the Bible? Why not some other kind of God that other people have thought of? Or maybe even a type of God that nobody's thought of? After all, there are hundreds of religions in our world, and we can, of course, imagine any kind of God we'd like. And of course, all of that's true. My response there would be that the God of the Bible has given evidence that he exists through a number of features that we find in connection with the Bible. One of these is fulfilled Bible prophecy. And I refer you for reading material to a work that I edited, a work of some of my students and myself and some other authors that had already had their works around, a work called The Evidence of Prophecy. We have lots of examples in that of prophecies that the Bible makes about the surrounding nations around Israel, prophecies that the Bible makes about Israel, prophecies that the Bible makes about Jesus. One of the prophecies about Tyre in Ezekiel 26 is that in the destruction of Tyre that is coming, and of course the Bible predicts destruction of many, many cities in the Bible, that the rock on which Tyre was built would be scraped and the dust would be thrown into the sea. Rather a striking sort of prediction, if you like. And yet it was something that was fulfilled several hundred years after Ezekiel's time, when Alexander the Great came through that area, and the city of Tyre, which had been destroyed earlier, its onshore version had been destroyed earlier by Nebuchadnezzar. The Tyrians had escaped to an island offshore, which they had part of their city on anyway. And now when Alexander arrives, the city of Tyre is on that offshore island, and he wants to conquer that. He doesn't want to leave a powerful city behind him, as he will be going further east with his forces. And so to get out to that city, he has the rock scraped and the rubble from the onshore city poured into the sea to build a causeway out to the island of Tyre, and the city is taken. The prophecies about Babylon occur a number of places in the scripture, but primarily in Isaiah 13 and Jeremiah 51, and predictions about its destruction are made as well, that there will be no Arabs living there, that there'll be no shepherds there anymore, that the stones won't be reused, that Babylon will become a parched desert. Well, Arabs were living all over the place, and would seem unlikely sort of thing, and yet in the centuries following the destruction of Babylon, it came to be viewed as haunted, and the Arabs are afraid to live there. Babylon once had grass around it and shepherds, but the grass disappears, and so there's no shepherds grazing the fields there. Babylon does have some stones used in building, but the stones are not reused for building in later centuries. Instead, the stones are burned to lime to make a cement, and it's the clay bricks that are reused for building. And Babylon, though it's set on an important major river, did in fact become a parched desert when that river moved in the course of its history. A flood of some sort shifted it into a new channel some distance upstream, and the result is that Babylon was left high and dry 15 to 20 miles from the relocated Euphrates River. Some striking fulfillments there as well. Now, when we think about Tyre and Babylon, you might say, well, disaster is going to happen to any city eventually if you wait long enough, and that's true. And yet there are very specific things said about Tyre that, for instance, if you traded it with its local partner city, Sidon, which was also a seacoast trading city and things of that sort, if you just changed the names of the two and the prophecies about them, you wouldn't have had fulfillment. But with the names the way they are, you do. And Babylon, major capital of an international empire, is one of the cities mentioned frequently in Scripture. But if you traded the prophecies about it with the prophecies about Nineveh, another major international capital, international empire capital, the prophecies would again not be true. Striking feature there we see in fulfilled Bible prophecy. We have prophecies about Israel as well, and I just pick one out here, and that's the prophecy in Hosea chapter 3. Hosea is instructed as kind of a very vivid acted parable to marry a woman named Gomer, whom Hosea is told in advance will be unfaithful. And this is to be an acted parable of God who has chosen the nation Israel, and God knows in advance that Israel will be unfaithful. And just as Hosea finds out that Gomer begins to play around with other people and eventually runs off with another man, so Israel begins to play around with other gods and goes off into idolatry, etc. But then Hosea is instructed in Hosea chapter 3 to go and buy back his wife. She's either fallen into slavery or she's become a prostitute, and so Hosea is instructed to pay enough money to have her services for a long time. And when she's been brought back, the relationship between Hosea and his wife Gomer will not be the usual relationship between husband and wife. It will be kind of a celibate relationship for a long period of time, for many days, because this will represent what's going to be the relationship between God and Israel for many days. And we're told in Hosea 3, verses 4 and 5, that Israel will be without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or idol for many days. So what kind of six, what should we say, sociological features of Israel's operation, its government, its religion, and such, are marked out for us. And the striking thing has been that these have been fulfilled in the past 2,000 years. Although God has set up a kingship in the family of David, Israelites will be without a king for this long period of time, and without even a prince. Prince in Hebrew means something like government official, not as specific as our prince, who would be the son of a king or something of the sort. God had set up an arrangement by which Israel had sacrificed, by which they approached God, but Israel is to be without that for a long time. The pillar here, some argument just what it might be, but probably the best guess is it's the sacred pillars of the Canaanites. And so you're looking at both the religion that had been given to the Israelites by God and the religions around them. And the picture is that Israel will not be off into idolatry, but neither will they be carrying out their sacrifices to God. Israel will be the ephod or idol. Ephod was a part of the attire of the high priest and the priests actually in general, and so the picture of Israel without priesthood and yet again without idolatry. The interesting thing has been that since about 70 A.D., Israel has lacked all of these things for nearly 2,000 years, and only with the reestablishment of the state of Israel in 1948 have they regained their prince. And we are told, in fact, in Hosea 3 that there will be a coming back at the end, and perhaps these things will they'll no longer be without those in that day. But very striking fulfillment there. Well, more of this in my work, The Evidence of Prophecy, and in Kenny Barfield's The Prophet Motive are two books that give us a good bit of information on fulfilled prophecy. Jesus, the prophecies about Jesus are rather striking as well. Isaiah 42 and 49 tells us Jesus will be a light to the Gentiles, and it's worth looking at those passages in some detail, which I do in other of my PowerPoint talks. But interesting phenomenon is there have been a number of Jews who have claimed to be the Messiah, but only one of them has founded a world religion of Gentiles, and that's Jesus. Daniel 9 tells us that the Messiah will be cut off at a specified date, and that works out to A.D. 28 through 35 A.D., a very period in which Jesus is put to death on the cross. So here the only Jewish claimant to be Messiah who has founded a world religion of Gentiles is also cut off at the specified date in this other prophecy. There are other prophecies of that sort, but I think those two are striking ones. The historical reliability of the gospel accounts has been commented on by a number of historians over the centuries, and if miracle is not ruled out in advance, the gospel accounts look very good. The reason why you frequently find in college courses on the Gospels and courses in ancient history that the Gospels tend to be poo-pooed is because the fellows doing the research have assumed in advance that miracles cannot occur. And of course, miracles cannot occur. Then the Gospels cannot be reliable because they've got a lot of miracles in them. But if you go into the study of the Gospels without making an assumption regarding whether miracles can occur or not, the Gospels look very, very good indeed. A nice book on this subject is Craig Blomberg's book, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. A number of people have noticed a huge difference between what we might call the first world and the third world, and have sometimes asked, what makes the first world different? And some people have noted, well, it has something to do with the democracy, it has something to do with science, it has something to do with technology and those sort of things. Well, it does have something to do with science and technology, but science and technology have Christian roots. It has something to do with personal freedom, but personal freedom has got Christian roots. Very nice treatment of the changes which Christianity has made in individual lives and particularly in societies show up in the books by James Kennedy and Jerry Newcomb, What If Jesus Had Never Been Born, and the book Under the Influence. Well, I'm going to suggest from this tour, and you may very well want to look in more detail at each of the sort of items I've discussed here, that these things we've discussed indicate that there is a God, and that he's not just some generic God, although he is the God of all people, but he's the God revealed in the Bible. And if there's a God, and he's the God revealed in the Bible, that tells us something very important, that human history does have significance, that something is really going on in human history, and it would be well for us to try and figure out what that is. It also tells us that our individual lives have significance, that life is not, as one of Shakespeare's characters said, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, but that our lives really do mean something. We need to find out what they're intended to mean and try and see that we not miss out on that. What we do with God will make all the difference between our lives being a disaster or being a joy beyond our imagining. But we're talking about Christianity. And Christianity puts Jesus in kind of the center of everything. And you might ask yourself, what's the place of Jesus in all this? Well, we've already suggested in looking at fulfilled prophecy that it centers in a pretty important way on Jesus. Jesus is pictured as a unique being in all the history of the universe. He's the one being in the universe who is both created, he becomes a human, but who is uncreated. He has always been God as well. And that turns out to be significant in regard to what Jesus claims about himself and what Jesus does, according to the Bible, in regard to helping us with the problem of getting things straightened out with God. Because Jesus is one, the only uncreated being who chose to become created, his obedience as a created being to God was not something that was antecedently owed. He didn't have to become a created being. And so all of his obedience as a created being is something that's voluntary, something that he doesn't owe. None of us chose to become created, and by the time we realize we're around and that we've got more responsibilities, we're pretty badly in debt. We've fallen pretty badly short of not loving God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength, and not even loving our neighbors, ourselves, not doing to others as we ought to do, as we would have them do to us, etc. And so we're building up a burden of what the Bible calls sin that we have no way of canceling out. But Jesus chose to become created. He does what in Roman Catholic theology has been called supererogation. In Catholic theology, this supererogation is something that the saints supposedly do, that they have more obedience than they need, and somehow they can transfer it to us. But that's not true. The best saints in history fall far short of what they ought to be, and they haven't got any extra righteousness to give away. The only one who's got any extra righteousness to give away is Jesus. And if we trust in him, his obedience counts as our obedience. And Jesus, being God, was able in his death on the cross to suffer something that would take us forever to suffer. And so if we trust him, his punishment counts as ours. So that's the place of Jesus in all of this. That he's the one who provided the kind of righteousness we should have provided, but didn't. Who died the kind of death we deserve to death, to die. And if we trust in him, his obedience counts as ours. And if we trust in him, his punishment counts as ours. And you too can trust in him. And that's what I invite you to do right now, today. If you do so, although this is the end of the talk, this will be the beginning of a new life for you if you trust in Jesus.